The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the Palestine policy is our red line. According to Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, this is what the Turkish premier has said when talking about improving ties with Israel. Now, there are questions as to why Turkey has chosen this time to talk about improving ties with Tel Aviv. One may ask, has Israeli aggression stopped toward Palestinians? Or have Israelis removed themselves from internationally recognized occupied territories? Or have illegal settlements increased that Erdogan wants better ties? So what exactly is going on here? Well, stay with us as we take a look at another decision by Erdogan, which is turning a lot of heads. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. We're going to start it all off, though, in Ramallah with Mona Kandil. Mona, fill us in on what's being said over there about this, why at this time the Palestinians may think that Erdogan wants to get closer to Israel.
Well, first of all, there hasn't been any official response from the Palestinian Authority on these news. However, Palestinians, the normal Palestinian people, would of course reject any relations between any country with Israel that they consider it's their enemy, and Israel is occupying the Palestinian lands. But experts were guessing that maybe Erdogan is trying to have this good relations with the coming U.S. administration, and that in a way or another he's trying to make the ties with Israel better. He said that the Palestine policy is a red line for Turkey, and at the same time he said that the Israeli policies towards the Palestinians is unacceptable. But for the Palestinian people, this is of course not enough, because there were reports saying at the time some Arab countries were signing reconciliation and normalization of ties with Israel, that Tayyip Erdogan appointed a new envoy to Israel, because in 2018 Turkey pulled back its envoy to Israel.
Okay, thanks so much for that update, Mona. Let me welcome my guest, Arin Berg, from the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier. Mick, thanks so much for being with us. Mick, your take on all this. What do you think is going on? Why now? Why do you think that Erdogan says he wants these warmer ties at this point in time?
Well, I'm not privy to the inner councils of the Turkish government, of course, but it's a very complex situation. On the one hand, almost the founding of the State of Israel, Turkey had a very strong strategic military relationship Turkey had a very close strategic relationship with Israel, and that lasted through thick and thin up until Erdogan's party began to rise in 2002-2003. So relations have always been very close, and even though there are political spats, so for example, when the Israelis murdered 10 Turkish citizens who were trying to challenge the siege of Gaza, all during that time, economic relations have been very close and have not really been challenged. And the Palestinian call for boycott of the State of Israel has completely been ignored by Turkey. The situation is complicated because Erdogan obviously has regional ambitions. He wants to present himself as a leader of the Muslim world. In order to do that, the Palestinian issue is obviously central. And normalizing with Israel and being seen to throw the Palestinians under the bus, as the UAE has done as Morocco has done and as Saudi is possibly preparing to do, would really run counter to those ambitions. So he has to tread a very difficult path. On the one hand, to try to present himself as a champion of Palestinian rights, but on the other hand, he's manoeuvring with, so for example, Greece and Cyprus have a very close relationship to Israel. They train together militarily. And against that axis, it seems to me that Erdogan is trying to re-establish links with Biden, which were very damaged under Trump, when he seemed to tilt a little bit towards Russia by buying Russian arms, which jeopardizes relations with NATO. Maybe he's trying to repair those links, and he, like the Gulf regimes, thinks that Israel is the royal road to Washington.
Well, thanks so much. Let me cross over to London and welcome Editor-in-Chief of the International Interests, Sami Hamdi. Thanks so much for being with us. Your take on all of this, you just heard our guest Mick there say basically perhaps it's a way to warm up to Biden. So the question would be, many say that the Trump administration has put pressure on many Muslim countries to try to make sure that they either establish ties or increase their ties with Israel. So what I want to ask you basically is how do you see Biden fitting in all of this? Do you think that it is the U.S. that is putting pressure on Turkey, or is it Erdogan acting independently?
I think it's important to note that Erdogan has the benefit of having inherited ties with Israel as opposed to establishing them. He inherited a legacy whereby Turkey, the first Muslim-majority country to recognize Israel in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. In other words, whereas Erdogan has always claimed that he is pro-Palestine, but despite not rolling back those relations, he has always been content with that. He has not sought to improve those relations or improve those particular ties. And we've seen that since Erdogan has been president, ties between Turkey and Israel have deteriorated rapidly until eventually the withdrawal of the ambassador in 2018. However, it's important to differentiate between words and actions. While Erdogan, personally, I believe that he genuinely has a distaste for Israel, while I believe that he genuinely has deep sympathies for the Palestinian causes, I think Erdogan is well aware what it means to go up against Israel. And that's why, despite the public rhetoric, despite the deterioration in diplomatic relations, we saw them cooperate with one another in Azerbaijan. We've seen Turkish Airlines, it flies to Tel Aviv, no problem with that whatsoever. We've seen Turkish advisors often come out and talk about the romantic possibilities of how great relations can be between Turkey and Israel. Even if Erdogan doesn't say it through his own mouth, he sends his advisors to say it, wary of balancing between this image as a sultan of the Muslim world and this image of a pragmatic nationalist Turkish leader. I think when it comes to this recent statement that came from Erdogan's own mouth, which is very unusual when it comes to issues related to Israel, I think it has entirely to do with Biden. It has entirely to do with the economy. But more important than that, it has to do with the Turks. I don't believe that Israel can offer anything to Erdogan in terms of foreign policy. Turkey is very strong in the East Med, it's strong in Libya, it's strong in Syria, it's strong in Azerbaijan, it's wrestling with Russia and doing very well at wrestling. But the Turks domestically are becoming increasingly tired at the economic cost, at the sanctions that were imposed, at the deteriorating lira, at the plummeting economy. And Erdogan is very concerned that Biden is going to be increasing that pressure with the prospect of sanctions, with the prospect of antagonism. And therefore, Erdogan wants to insulate this economy in his economy in the only way he knows how, particularly given that the elections are coming up soon, by relying on Israel in the same way that the UAE, Qatar, Saudi, Morocco, and the others have relied on Israel to open the door to the White House to say, look, let's talk, let's sit down, but okay, please don't let Biden go after my economy. And this is why I think that we see the statement coming from Erdogan. It's not about foreign policy. It's not about his love for Israel. The tragedy is that he is now leaning on Israel to get some economic benefit so that he can win over the Turks, win over his own people, so that he can win the elections. Okay. That's the tragedy, to rely on the occupier to please the Muslims.
What do you think about that, Mick? You heard what Sami said. I mean, to he said basically to bring his own people on board. But if we look at the Turkish nation in general, one would think that the majority of them are actually pro-Palestinian, pro-Palestinian cause. But I want your take on what Sami has just said. Do you think that really the Turkish government is thinking in that way, that it's going to take actually ties with Israel or improving ties with Israel in order to help its own economy?
Well, yes. I mean, Sami's expanded in a much more sophisticated way than what I said earlier. But this is to do with trying to beat a path to Biden, trying to improve relations with Israel. And the Palestinians have nothing much to offer Turkish government at the moment. The problem is the Mavi Marmara went quite deep into the body politic. And when Israel killed 10 Turkish citizens, it was very difficult for the Turkish government to push that to one side. And the behavior of Israel ever since then has forced Erdogan to seem to be very hostile to Israel. Not just at the Davos Forum, where he stood up and made a blistering verbal attack on Israel. Not just in various other fora, where he's been verbally very critical. But he has to try to conciliate public opinion. He has to ride the tiger of public opinion on the one hand and try to achieve what Sami has said on the other. Get the trade enhanced with Israel, to see off the threat of sanctions from Joe Biden, who is no less of a cold warrior than Donald Trump was, possibly even more. So Erdogan's in a very difficult situation. The fact is that Israel has been cultivating governments in the region, not just in the Gulf, but very, very firmly the Greek government and the Cypriot government. And Erdogan is in fierce competition with these two in the Eastern Mediterranean. He needs all the allies he can get. At the very least, if he can neutralize Israel in his effort to access hydrocarbons in the Eastern Med, this will be a strategic calculation as well. But yes, it's another government lining up to beat a path to Washington, to normalize relations with Israel, and actually the Palestinians don't have any counter pressure except that of popularity with Turkish public opinion, and Erdogan thinks he can marginalize that.
Well, Sami, your take, what you said as far as helping with domestic issues, why is it that we see more and more Muslim countries actually turning towards Israel instead of trying to expand cooperation with each other, for example, with Turkey and the region it is in? Of course, there's hostilities right now between Turkey and Syria. But if it tried to go in the other direction and try to expand ties in its own region and strengthen ties in its own region, couldn't that help it economically instead of turning to the occupier of Palestinian land?
I think that it's important to highlight that while the Turks sympathize with the Palestinian cause, it's important to understand that Turkish foreign policy is heavily nationalist and not necessarily Islamist in the way that perhaps Erdogan presents himself. While we hear Islamist rhetoric, the unfortunate reality is that Erdogan has only ever been able to garner public support for his foreign policy when he has presented it in a nationalist lens, whether that's Azerbaijan, two states, one people, two states, whether that's in Libya, interest of the Eastern Mediterranean, whether that's Syria, PKK and YPG, as opposed to this wider ideal that he often preaches about one community, one Muslim world. I think the direct answer to your question leans on this, in that Turkey has always had to balance between this nationalism that Atatürk used to withdraw Turkey from the Muslim world, and versus Erdogan's deeply held personal beliefs about bringing Turkey back to the Islamic world. While Erdogan believes in the latter, the Turks are still stuck in the former. And that's why we see that when it comes to elections, the closer we get, the more nationalist that Erdogan becomes in his rhetoric, in his policies. And this is why when we look at what's going on in the region, Turkey's relations with Saudi and with the UAE and the like, the reality is that the relations are still very self-interested, both on the Turkish part and on the Arab part. The second issue, and it's important to highlight this very fundamental issue, is this reliance not necessarily on Israel, but on United States power. when Qatar wants to pursue an independent foreign policy, between quotation marks, it hands a third of its land to the US to establish a Udaid military base that it points towards Saudi, that it points towards its other neighbors to pursue an independent foreign policy. The UAE, in order to assert its independent foreign policy, again between quotation marks, it brings a US military base. Saudi, to assert independence against Qatar and against the UAE, who are pointing these bases, brings its own US military base. In other words, each one starts pointing towards the other by bringing external power that plays them off one another in terms of extracting billions of dollars in investment and the like, to ensure that there is never really any effective unity. And I think we've seen that bids to unite the powers, whether that's the Saudi Arabia ambition or initiative in the 1990s, whether that's the initiative of the North African countries, the reality is that the US always manages to get one of these smaller countries in order to act up. They bring the American military base and they scupper those sorts of initiative. And that's why I think the reality is that it's not necessarily can these countries take agency for themselves. The reality is you have to remember this is a region where there is a very powerful hegemonic power called the United States of America with extensive military bases that has assassinated leaders that have fallen out of line, that has gone to war with countries with made up UN resolutions and with declarations against people that it doesn't like, that has exacerbated ideas of terrorism and the like in order to establish hegemony in the region. It's not easy to go rogue, it's not easy to go independent, and I think these harsh realities are what ensure that this status quo continues in the way that it is.
Okay, well, Nick, now Erdogan says he wants to cooperate with Israel, especially in intelligence. What do you think exactly that means? Because we've seen Israeli intelligence attempt to destabilize the region, as well as be involved in many assassination terrorist acts. So what does that mean when he says he's looking at perhaps cooperating with the intelligence with Israel?
Well, I think he says that their intelligence groups are currently working closely together, and I think that is the case. See, I think the difference between the Gulf monarchies like the UAE, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia is that they are inherently unstable. They're hydrocarbon extraction states with very little other resources to base themselves on. Their elites rely upon the United States almost for their existence. Israel also, in a very different way, because it's constantly in tension or at war with the whole area, also relies on the link, the military and the financial link, the air bridge of arms and finance between Washington and Israel, almost relies on that to continue in its present form. I think Turkey and to a lesser extent Egypt are a little bit different. They've got very large populations. They don't rely substantially on oil and gas, and certainly Turkey has ambitions throughout the whole region, which it can promote. It doesn't rely on the USA to quite the same extent, and we've seen that recently with its tilt towards Moscow, with the buying of the S-400 air defence system, and real anger. Fury in the Pentagon and right across the whole of NATO, and Turkey was able to maintain that position, but now it seems to be tilting towards Washington. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's quite under American domination in the same way that the Gulf regimes are. It's got more freedom for manoeuvre, so it's a tilt. It's certainly prepared to throw the Palestinians under the bus in the same way that the Gulf monarchies have done. But that's in pursuit of its own regional hegemony. I mean, and towards that end, Turkey has a record of cooperating with Israel against, for example, Iran. Mm-hmm. Ministers have met together. Erdogan actually made a visit to Israel, I think it was in 2007, around the time where an Israeli minister said their relations were perfect. And Erdogan said, yes, Iranian nuclear ambitions are a threat towards the whole region. Absolutely silent on Israel's possession of arsenals of mass destruction.
Okay.
So I think Turkey has more room for maneuver. It's quite prepared to ally with Israel against other challenges in the region. And at the moment, it seems to be seeking favor with Biden, seeing the opportunity of Trump's disappearance.
Okay. Well, Sami, looking at this whole situation and what's going on, and if Turkey is going to increase its relations with Israel, what does it all mean for the Palestinians themselves and the Palestinian cause? How do you see that being affected?
I think the Palestinian cause is in dire straits. It's been in dire straits for some time. The reality is that it is true that Erdogan gave some hope for the Palestinians and the Muslim world with his rhetoric, with the idea of Turkey becoming a power, with Turkey asserting itself in Syria and Libya and the East Med, with Turkey sitting on the same table as Russia and the U.S. I think many Palestinians hoped that that would be reflected in perhaps drones being given to the Palestinians, the Bayraktar drones, whether it's increased support, isolation of Israel, whether it's leading some movement towards pressuring Israel. But instead, they're seeing the opposite. They're seeing that not only are the UAE and Morocco normalizing ties, but that Erdogan is leaning on this narrative of, I'm not the one who normalized ties, but given we already have them, I'm not going to reverse them, and I'm going to go back to Israel and improve my ties and improve relations. Again, not necessarily because Erdogan likes Israel, but because he needs them. So I think the Palestinians will look in the sense that Erdogan lifted our hopes for the past 10 years, and suddenly they've been dashed as he's expressed this weakness that perhaps wasn't expressed beforehand. But I do think the reality is that for the Palestinians, I think all of this is a learning curve, in that the reality is that resistance has to come from the Palestinians. It has to come from a unified effort by the Palestinians. They have to take it for themselves, because the reality is that nations often pursue these policies in self-interest. As an Algerian myself, we know that the War of Independence began by Algerians inside Algeria without international support, albeit some from Nasser, but they had to take the initiative themselves within Algeria before they managed to cause this snowball effect. I think the Palestinians, Fatah and Hamas, this division between them, doesn't help their cause. I think they have to unite, they have to find some sort of block, and they have to stop relying in the manner that Mahmoud Abbas is doing on the Saudis, on the UAE and the like, who force him to swallow these normalization like a bitter pill, because he has no other options available to him. There needs to be greater agency for the Palestinians, and I think the complacency that has settled in over the past decade amongst the Palestinians, I think what's happening with normalization, with Erdogan and the like, is a welcome wake-up call in reminding the Palestinians that they have to fight for their freedom, they must fight for their liberation, and this idea that it is impossible or that they rely on others is not going to benefit them.
All right. Thank you both for being with us. We're out of time in this program. Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign member Mick Napier at Edinburgh and Editor-in-Chief of the International Interest, Sami Hamdi, out of London. Appreciate both of you being with us. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Hope to see you right here, same time tomorrow.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan, letter C, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أَفَلَمْ يَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَتَكُونَ لَهُمْ قُلُوبٌ يَعْقِلُونَ بِهَا
So have they not traveled through the earth, and have hearts by which to reason, and ears by which to hear? For indeed, it is not eyes that are blinded, but blinded are the hearts which are within the breasts.
Dear listeners, we were talking about the 46th verse. أَفَلَمْ يَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَتَكُونَ لَهُمْ قُلُوبٌ يَعْقِلُونَ بِهَا أَوْ آذَانٌ يَسْمَعُونَ بِهَا. Have they not traveled in the land so that they should have hearts wherewith to understand, or ears wherewith to hear? فَإِنَّهَا لَا تَعْمَ الْأَبْصَارِ وَلَكِنْ تَعْمَ الْقُلُوبُ الَّتِي فِي الصُّدُورِ. Verily, blind are not the eyes, but blind are the hearts which are in the breasts. So, previously we concluded that the verse is talking about the experimental and scientific voyages, which are a fundamental part of development of knowledge in the universe, and it sometimes can be even more valuable than studying the books of the previous people, of the people who were living thousands of years ago. So this travel must be godly, and the man should take lessons and new advices from these ancient traces, such as Iwan Madain, the ruined palaces of the tyrant kings and the castles of pharaohs. So in order to make the reality of this speech more clear, the Quran implies that there are many people who are not apparently blind or deaf, but they are indeed blind and deaf, because it is not the outward eyes which become blind, but it is their hearts which lose their insight. The holy verse continues saying, فَإِنَّهَا لَا تَعْمَ الْأَبْصَارِ وَلَكِنْ تَعْمَ الْقُلُوبُ الَّتِي فِي الصُّدُورِ. Verily, blind are not the eyes, but blind are the hearts which are in the breasts. In fact, those who lose their apparent eyes are not blind, and sometimes they are more enlightened people who are more aware than others, and we have clearly seen examples throughout our lives. The true blind are those whose hearts are blind and do not perceive the truth. The Holy Prophet has said in a tradition, the worst blindness is the blindness of the heart. And he also has said, the utmost blindness of the blindness is the blindness of the heart.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, We will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So this verse is exactly mentioning the means that man is provided with for understanding the truth. At first, it is the eyes and the ears. And second, it is intellect and mind. In this matter, the Prophet ﷺ has said, when Allah intends to do a favor to a servant, he causes the eye of his heart to open, by which he can see whatever was concealed to him. We know that man's heart is merely a pump for circulation of the blood. But the question is, how have the hearts in the breasts been attributed to comprehending the facts? The answer to this question has been explained vastly in the books of Al-Mizan and also Tafsir Nimuna. But shortly explained, we have to start from the meaning of the Quranic word Qalb, since one of the meanings of this word is wisdom, and one of the meanings of the Arabic word Sadr, or chest, in the Holy Quran is the essence and nature of man. And the heart is the symbol of man's affections. Whenever something of affections, which is often the origin of movement, appears in the spirit of man, its first effect is seen on his heart. The heartbeat changes, the blood reaches all parts and particles of the body, which gives it a new joy and power. So, when the spiritual moods are attributed to the heart, it is because their first place of appearance in the man's body is his heart. And it is interesting that in this verse, all man's perceptions have been attributed to the heart and ears. And this implies that for comprehending the facts, there are only two ways. Either man must have something from his own and in his own spirit by which he personally analyzes the matters and gets necessary results, or he should listen to the advice of the kind advisors, the guides of the way, the divine prophets, and the man of truth, or he can utilize both of them to obtain the facts. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. Your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, Take care.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when fate begins?
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam my deen. Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, other life forms, you are listening to Youth Station, only on IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Zainab.
I'm Mehdi, and I'm also here.
He's my co-host, and he's totally excited to be here, you guys. Just ignore his bored, sleepy sort of tone. How have you been?
I haven't been bad.
Do you think you're living your best life right now?
Yeah, I could say so, yeah. My best life?
Yeah.
Yeah, my best life in the sense that I'm doing what I want to do.
Uh-huh.
And it's not bad. It's turning out the way, at times, I want it to be.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but I could have been better, and I still can be better, and I hopefully will be.
So, Basically, your definition of your best life is to live the life that you planned.
Or something that I did not plan but turned out to be in my favor.
How would you define favor? Is it material favor, spiritual favor?
Yes, kind of both. At times it is something material that comes your way which you completely did not expect. Or it's at times spiritual that you never wanted to go that way, but time and circumstances took you there and you didn't regret that happened.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for not asking, but yeah, I'd say I'm living my best life too. No one ever cares to ask me questions on this show. I'm so left out.
No, you're actually a lot expressive, so there's no need to ask questions when it's already coming out, you know?
Did you just indirectly call me talkative?
No, I just said you're expressive in the sense that, you know, you're very comfortable to be around with.
If I were to say whether or not I'm living my best life, the answer would be Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen, I definitely am. And
like, if someone looks at you from another perspective, would they also say that about you, that this is the best you could have done?
I think it depends. That's a very good question. And I think it's mainly depends on the priorities and criteria we set for ourselves in our lives. Because another person...
How do you set those?
How do I set those?
Yeah.
Yet another good question. You're on fire. Well, let's start with defining our priorities first. Another woman my age could be pursuing and defining different things as success, right? Her success could be making more money. Success for her could be buying a new house. Success for her could be getting that promotion, becoming the president of a totally successful, I don't know, ad firm or something. That could be a good thing, but I base my success on things that are worthwhile, you know, things that last.
Yeah, but that's worthwhile for someone else, right?
But then they die.
Mm-hmm. When you don't.
It's possible. I am that fabulous. But I feel like what I'm doing right now in my life, when I do die, sooner or later, when I do die, I hope to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that some of the things that I've done would manifest themselves in the hereafter.
They absolutely do in this world, so there's no doubt they won't.
In a positive way.
Yeah, exactly. No, not necessarily. Everything that we do does manifest itself positively and negatively, right?
Yep.
And I don't know how you're so sure that there isn't any negative manifestation over there, but of course that's your life and you're sure about that.
I never said
that.
How did you get that from what I said?
I don't know, you said positive, so I was like...
No, I'm saying that's my goal in life, right. And the more often it turns out that way, the more I feel I'm living my best life. The more often I get to do things that I feel will have a good outcome in the hereafter, the more I feel successful. Yeah, I mess up all the time, right? And it's probably going to turn into hellfire and zakum for me on the other side.
Hopefully not.
But that's my definition of living my best life.
You know the verse, okay, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم لقد كان في رسول الله أسوة حسنة لمن كان يرجو الله واليوم الآخر. This is, I think, a summary of what we've been talking about, I think, right? It's very obvious that I'm not a prophet, so I cannot relate my in the terms of being a prophet and saying that that's my role model and he's a prophet, so I'll be a prophet. No, but the small things that he does, the small things that we've seen from him and have heard from him, of course, haven't seen from him, are things that guide us where we should head towards, right?
Oh, so I this is the answer to your own question. You were saying that how do you set that priority and criteria?
Because I had the answer, which is why I asked the question, you know, so that I could act smart and
incredibly,
you know, answer
British
the
of you, bro.
No.
I wasn't being racist at all. Okay.
What was I saying? I lost myself.
So we were talking about the how, which is basically the main question of today's episode anyway. Are we living our best lives? If not, how? If yes, how? Right? And you're saying that...
I was saying that the only way to find out, well, yeah, the only way, literally, to find out if what I'm doing is actually true, or like the best way is to be able to study and find out how they lived their lives, him, the Prophet, peace be upon him, and those very like him, right? That's how we find out if what I'm doing in my life is something that I'm supposed to do. And something brilliant I remembered just now was, I'm going to take his name right now because I respect that person, Sheikh Farooq Sikalishvar. He said something so mind-blowing. He said that whatever you do right now, be it, I don't know, a cashier at McDonald's, I don't know,
a host on the radio,
or, you know, whatever, at KPMG, whatever you do, ask yourself this question. If right now the Imam of our time, Imam Sahib al-Asr al-Zaman alayhi salam, he arrives, or he's here, you know, but if he comes out of the occultation,
he reappears.
If you plan on doing what you're doing right now, then also, then carry on doing what you're doing right now. But if you think there's something you might change when he arrives, then why not right now? Take this step right now, you know? Yeah. Don't be very late. So, yeah, that's something.
Yeah, that is perhaps the perfect how to living our best lives, you know? Mm-hmm. Because especially nowadays, I feel like, dang it, this is so cliche. And I always tell myself that I'm not going to be that person. But the more I live and the more I research and the more I talk about it, the more I become that person, that whatever happens, they point the finger at social media. Because it's all over the place and it's affecting the youth lives so much. And, you know, quote-unquote influencers.
Yep.
Yeah. Right? It seems like they are the setting the bars nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, they're setting the standards. And it's so sad because, number one, our youth, mashallah, especially the Muslim youth, with the role models that they have, with the potential that they have, with the upbringing that they should have or could have had, they can do so much better than to aspire to be like a certain quote-unquote influencer.
But that's also our fault, isn't it? Because
our fault, who's our? Us as parents, us as youth?
You're right, that's a good question. Us as Muslims who have basic know-how of using the social media, for example, right? Why is it that someone has been able to do that to your people as a nation? Or humanity, and you've sat there and done nothing.
Nothing about it. That is so true.
And there are brothers and sisters who
are trying.
Yeah.
They really are, mashallah to them.
And they're actually doing a very good job. But yeah, we need that a lot more. And these influencers, we have to break that monopoly, I think, that is completely one-sided right now. Yeah.
Why do you think the reason is that more Muslims aren't expressing themselves as quote-unquote influencers? Yeah, it's just at a loss for a better word. I'll think of a better word for my next sentence. But for now, why do you think Muslims aren't trying more to become influencers, to set examples for what the youth should aspire to be, what the best life looks like from an Islamic perspective? Why is that?
It might be, because I'm not sure, right? But it might be one of the things that I had in my mind earlier on is that, well, I'm busy with myself, you know, I need to be a better person myself, and I need to, you know, finishing myself. And then, the furnishing and the finishing of a house. Like, I need to do that. And then I'll move on to society, you know.
Right.
These things, it's a good thought, like, but, you know,
kalimatu haqqin wa yuradu bihil
batil. It's like, it's a slogan that's very beautiful and it's nice, but that's just an excuse to not move your neck from the chair and do something,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Just shy away from the responsibility, you know.
Yeah.
Something else that I feel is that, it's exactly what you said, but in like another atmosphere where in the Islamic society, they're not called influencers, they're called scholars or public figures, whatever that means. And I think, number one, we all have an aspect of us which is a public figure.
How?
Stay with me.
All right.
I have the version of Zainab, which is just at home, you know, my private life, and I have a version of Zainab that I display when I'm with other people. Obviously, these two versions will differ in a way or another, right?
Yeah.
And so no matter who I am as a Muslim, whether I am a scholar or not, whether I have a turban or not, which I never will have because I'm a woman, I'm glad you clarified that. I do what I can. I will still have an aspect of me which is public, which brings about some responsibilities for me as Zainab. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah,
I don't necessarily have to have a pulpit or a mimbar to take responsibility regarding my relationship with other people. Number one, right? So anyone can influence anyone at this point.
Right.
Right?
But you're not limited to social media right now in your
speech. Right, exactly. I don't necessarily have to have a page with like 23,000 followers and like 1,100 posts. And point being, I don't necessarily have to have that platform, quote unquote, to try to influence other people. The other thing about it that I feel why our Muslim people are shying away from helping each other, influencing each other, reminding each other what the best life could be, is that we are shy to show the world that we are in the process of growth ourselves. Like what you said, we feel like I need to reach the certain point, then I can preach other people.
You're right.
I know that we should like act upon what we preach, but then it's a process anyway. We're not perfect. Like what you said again, we're not infallible. We're not a prophet. I'm just Zainab. I grow with you, you grow with me. I tell you, you tell me. I remind you, you remind me. We live our best lives together. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I want to clarify. When you said that we have two perspectives or like two faces, is that hypocrisy? I don't think so.
Yes.
Yes, is it? It is?
No, I don't think so. Yes, I don't think so either.
Right, because, for example, you have to have certain things that you keep to yourselves, like probably.
Exactly. It's called private life. Hello.
Yeah, so, yeah. I hope you didn't mean like you have multiple personalities, but you meant that that one personality has got different channels that play at different times, right?
That's totally what I meant.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get through to the audience so that they don't confuse.
Though I think they probably think that already.
You're bipolar or something.
Out of time? Yeah. That's it for today's episode. Inshallah ta'ala, I hope that wherever you are and whatever you're doing, Allah aids us all in trying to live our best lives and get closer to the models and examples that we have as Muslims, which is the wonderful existence of our noble and beloved Prophet, and getting closer to the satisfaction of our master Sahab al-Asr al-Zaman. Until another episode of Youth Station, we leave you in the kind protection of Allah. Wash your hands, wear a mask. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. To have your precious love in my life. Now I know how it feels to finally be at peace inside. I wish that everybody knew how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free. Set me free and make me strong.
Round the world with reporters.
The floating Safa reservoir north of the port of Hodeidah, which carries a million barrels of crude oil, poses a great environmental risk since it has not been put under any maintenance since the beginning of the war on Yemen. Recently, an agreement was reached between Sana'a and the United Nations to maintain the reservoir. Sana'a has already signed the agreement, while the UN is still stalling until today.
The Ministry of Foreign Affairs facilitated the entry of technical experts for the maintenance of the safer tank, as it was agreed upon in July. But we were surprised by the United Nations postponement of the operation to February next year, and we do not know about the reasons. We hope the United Nations will expedite the dispatch of maintenance teams for the safer tank, because if a leak occurred, it would constitute a major disaster.
The Supreme Economic Committee confirms that the United Nations has not yet signed the agreement and surprised everyone by delaying the arrival of experts until February 15th, which could cause a disaster because the water had already entered the engine of the tanker, threatening it to sink or explode.
The United Nations is using the safer oil vessel as a pretext to impose political and economic pressure on the government of Sana'a. The Saudi-led coalition, on the other hand, has also used the tanker to implement its own agenda, despite greater dangers that also threatening the Suez Canal.
The delay of the maintenance operation, as well as the continued detention of oil ships by the Saudi coalition, has led to an oil derivative crisis from which Yemenis have been suffering for months. This has also reflected negatively on the health sector.
Experts confirm that the sinking of the reservoir will cause an environmental catastrophe from which Yemen will not recover for more than 30 years until it gets rid of the dire consequences of contamination. The crisis will also cause the extinction of millions of marine life from the Red Sea. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a, Yemen.
Christmas Eve 2020, Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed off on an historic post-Brexit trade and security agreement with the European Union after an intense 24-hour negotiation period. A press conference expected early in the day finally came in the afternoon after lawyers and translators had crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
I'm very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have completed the biggest trade deal yet, worth £660 billion. A year, a comprehensive Canada-style free trade deal between the UK and the EU, a deal that will protect jobs across this country, a deal that will allow goods, UK goods and components to be sold without tariffs and without quotas in the EU market, a deal which will, if anything, allow our companies and our exporters to do even more business with our European friends.
A deal will mean Britain finally leaving the bloc's single market and customs union in a week, and freedom of movement will end. It also settles the future arrangements on a vast range of issues, from aviation and transport to civil nuclear cooperation and energy. The sticking points that took Brexit to the brink of no deal was access to British fishing waters, a contentious issue that prompted the UK to send Navy ships to the English Channel in case of clashes, and the level playing field, which is an important part of the EU single market, allowing for fair and open competition.
Les négociations ont été très difficiles.
The negotiations were very difficult, with lots at stake for many, and it was an agreement worth fighting for. It will allow us to avoid major disruptions to workers, businesses and travellers after January 1st. It will protect European interests, and this agreement is also, I believe, in the interests of the United Kingdom. It will lay solid foundations for a new start with long-time friends, and finally, it will ensure we can leave Brexit behind us. Europe continues to move forward. Despite the collective sighs of relief and resignation across Britain, the devil is in the detail. French media made waves in the hours leading up to it by asserting the UK had made huge concessions, something Westminster was quick to deny. Hardline Tory Brexiteers from the European Research Group have said its star chamber of lawyers will be convened to analyse the proposed agreement, suggesting it's not over yet. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Since its independence in November 1948, Lebanon, the small Arab country, has been the scene of a myriad of conflicts, challenges, and political bickering. The year 2020 was not unlike any other year, but even more challenging. As the country was engulfed in the economic, financial, and monetary crisis, another challenge hit the global scene in the form of a novel coronavirus. The first few positive cases of COVID-19 in Lebanon forced the country like the rest of the world, into a lockdown. This lockdown was preceded by an unseen monetary crisis where the Lebanese lira plummeted against the U.S. dollar. U.S. sanctions on Lebanon led banks to limit cash withdrawals, and queues were seen daily facing banks. Observers look at the year 2020 as being one of the darkest periods in Lebanon's history.
We've lost everything, literally. You know, we've lost the companies, we've lost the banks, we've lost the economical system, we've lost the political system. There's nothing left. And you know, when you have nothing left, the only thing left is humans and their potentials.
The overall system of governance in Lebanon is seen as something that needs to end. Waking up to a new crisis had become a norm until the Beirut